I have a handout going around that's pictures. So I think Neoplatonism requires a lot of visual aids, especially when explaining different theories. 20th century scholarship on Thomas Aquinas brought with it a great sensitivity to the Platonic and Neoplatonic aspects of the angelic doctor's philosophical thought. Unfortunately, this has also resulted in interminable debates about which adjectival label best characterizes Aquinas, whether he can be called an Aristotelian truly or whether he ought to be referred to as some variety of Platonist. I believe it's far more constructive, following the language of Cornelio Fabro, to insist that the philosophy of Aquinas is an emergent synthesis, a synthesis that cannot merely be reduced to one of its constituent parts, a synthesis that's much greater than even the sum total of its parts. And certain passages make it especially clear that Aquinas did not feel bound by our typical assessment of what constitutes Aristotelianism or Platonism. And for me, the passage that I love to share to illustrate this point and kind of crystallizes Aquinas' flexibility in this regard and reveals his own audacity in his own project, this quote from the Treatise on Separate Substances illustrates this, where Aquinas highlights the congruence between Plato and Aristotle. And in virtually the same breath, Aquinas talks about Plato's doctrine of potency and act and Aristotle's doctrine of participation. It's the kind of thing where you read and then you have to read again. There's a double take. Did you misspeak? So there's a very flexible synthesis that he's comfortable with. So I offer that tiny prologue as an explanation for why such a seemingly obscure topic merits interest, the Neoplatonic triad of being, life, and intellect. A greater appreciation of Aquinas' Platonic sources will come not by attempting to give Aquinas' metaphysical thought a single label, but by carefully attending to the way in which he adapts and adopts certain Neoplatonic ideas into his own thought. And the triad of being, life, and intellect is one central Neoplatonic idea that Aquinas severely modifies but does not wholly discard. And evidence of this can be found throughout the three works I'll sort of be drawing from, which have been labeled the three Neoplatonic treatises: the Commentary on the Divine Names, the Treatise on Separate Substances, and the Commentary on the Book of Causes. In his prologue to the Commentary on the Divine Names, Aquinas remarks that Dionysius used the style of speaking of the Platonists, which is foreign to modern readers. I just love it when Aquinas refers to himself as a modern man. So Aquinas here is talking about the Platonici, the Platonists, insofar as he understands them. Also, it's interesting, if you read the Treatise on Separate Substances, there's a way in which he acknowledges that he has much more direct contact with Aristotle's works than with Plato's, so he's sort of being in the spirit of full disclosure. In particular, Aquinas says that the Platonists reduce composite things to abstract principles. Man and horse exist as separate species, and any given man or horse we encounter only exist as such by participation. This is the Platonism we typically associate with Plato. But Aquinas notes that the Platonists took it a step further. Not only did they posit separate natural species, but they posited separately existing entities of what is most common, maxime communia, good, one, and being. And they posited one principle that was itself the essence of goodness, unity, and being. So then Aquinas offers a conclusion we might be surprised to hear stated so strongly. Quote, "Thus, this reasoning of the Platonists does not accord with the faith or truth insofar as it concerns natural separate species. But inasmuch as they are speaking about that which is the first principle of things, their opinion is most true and harmonizes with the Christian faith." In other words, despite the evident strangeness of the doctrine of forms, the Platonists, in fact, hit the nail on the head in regard to an ultimate first principle and qualities of it. Aquinas' positive affirmation of the Platonists can also extend to the views of certain Platonists in regard to being, life, and intellect. I think this is a sort of central key worthy of our interest and study. Neoplatonism is an attempt, or at least simplistically put, to systematize the works of Plato into a coherent body of doctrine and to tighten up his metaphysics. In particular, the messiness of the Platonic heavens, full of forms for anything and everything, is organized into a neat and tidy procession from an ultimate first principle. there also was a sort of gap left by the rift between the idealized forms and the world of ephemeral, phenomenal, less than real, material things. And so the gap has to be bridged somehow, at least in this analysis I'm following Fabreau. And this helps us understand the need for Proclus's separate hypostases of being, life, and intellect. They occupy the middle space between the ultimate first principle and everything else. Proclus held that being, life, and intellect subsisted on their own. And they were ontologically inferior to the ultimate first principle, yet superior and causing, or at least informing, everything inferior to them. So thus results a three-tiered ontology of participation. We have the participated, participations, and participants. So it's rather confusing and tongue-twisting even to say, but it's part of why I've given you the handout to see the way you could potentially schematize it. Aquinas explains in his critique of this view in the Treatise on Separate Substances, he explains how he understands this view. Quote, "The first and highest among these separate principles is that which is being itself. And this is the first principle, God, of whom we have said that he is his own being. Under this principle, they, the Platonici, posited another separate principle, life, and again another intellect. If, therefore, there be some immaterial substance," it's because it's the Treatise on Separate Substances, he's especially focused on them. "If there be some immaterial substance which is intelligent, living, and being, it will be a being through participation in the first principle, which is being itself. It will be living through participation in the second separate principle, which is life. And it will be intelligent through a participation in another separate principle, which is the intellect itself." So this actually, and I think as the number of crossed lines sort of demonstrate in the handout, this begins to threaten the unity of the creature. And this is where Thomas begins, that this position is in contrast to the general axiom that an effect cannot be simpler than its cause. So a single effect cannot be reduced to multiple first principles that each possess the same mode of causality. For the Platonici view to be correct, being a living being and being an intelligent thing would need to be joined in some accidental fashion to a pre-existing substrate of being. However, we know that in things that are living, they're living and understanding from the same principle that they are beings. And thus, the giver of being, God, is also the giver of life and of intelligence. So in the Treatise on Separate Substances, Thomas addresses this from two different angles. One, in the beginning part, when it's primarily philosophical, but also he gives a theological critique of it later on. Beginning with the authority of the scriptures, he shows a few places in which God is identified as the one source of not only being, but also goodness and life, passages familiar to all of us. Quote, in the canonical scriptures, it is attributed to the one and same God that he is the very essence of goodness. Accordingly, it is said in Matthew 19, one is good, God, and that he is being itself. Therefore, in Exodus 3:14, God answers Moses, who asks, what is God's name? I am who am. And that he himself is the life of living beings. Accordingly, as it is said in Deuteronomy 3:20, he is the life of the living. So the decisive language of the scriptures leaves no room for the causal role of separate hypostases of being, life, and intellect. So in a way, not only would these separate principles threaten the unity of the creature on the one hand, they also threaten the unity of the creator. So in summary, if we're going to claim there's such a thing as subsistent being, subsistent life, and subsistent intelligence, then they all need to be identified with God himself. There's no room for a middle category of separate hypostases, since being, life, and intellect need to be forced into the ultimate first principle. And so the ontology is no longer that of a three-tiered participation, but of two. Everything is either being itself, God, or being by participation. So that's meant to be the other side of the handout with Thomas's assessment. Thomas points out that Dionysius has a helpful critique aimed against the Platonici as well. Quote, and Aquinas is here quoting Pseudo-Dionysius, "Only the supersubstantial being itself, namely of the highest God, is the principle and substance and cause that all things are by nature." principle and substance and cause of all things that are by nature. Now, really, to do justice to these ideas, I'd need at least another category on that handout of Dionysius' conception. This is, you know, kind of merits its own study to consider, well, exactly what way Dionysius understands being to be in relation to God, because he's, of course, so indebted as he is to the Neoplatonic tradition, he's very hesitant to identify God with being simply, so he's very common saying he's the superbeing, above being, beyond being. For more on this and to really tease out the differences, I recommend the last chapter of Rudy Tevelde's book, Participation in Substantiality. If we limit ourselves to the treatment of the triad in the treatise on separate substances, we're left with a fairly negative impression. However, when understood in the proper way and in light of other texts from Thomas's corpus, the triad is not something Thomas discards, but something that he modifies and integrates into his own synthesis. Speaking of the metaphysical structure presented in the commentary on the Liber de Causis, which is associated with Proclus, Fabro reflects that despite Thomas's sharp corrective of the doctrine, for instance, of a mediated creation, it's a separate issue but similar, Fabro says, all in all, we can say that in the end, according to the able exegesis of Aquinas, the metaphysical marrow of these doctrines can come to be assimilated and widely used, end quote. The triad of being, life, and intelligence, I maintain, is one of the most important parts of this metaphysical marrow that Thomas assimilates. So how would we really describe being, life, and intellect if we were to put them into a category in Aquinas' synthesis? So here I'll be going through a few texts from the commentary on the Liber de Causis. The triad seems to surface itself in another important way in discussing the structure of reality. In his commentary, Proposition 18 of the Liber de Causis, Thomas notes the fundamental division it provides. All the grades of things seem to reduce to three: being, living, and knowing. And this is so because everything can be considered in a threefold way. First, in itself, thus being is proper to it. Second, insofar as it tends to something else, and thus to move itself is proper to it. Third, insofar as it has other things in itself, and thus to know is proper to it, since knowledge is accomplished because the known is in the knower, not materially but formally. Thomas also explains the criteria by which a thing is considered living and intelligent. It might surprise us how things make the cut. He really does value sense knowledge in animals. So I have another quote there to go through, but I think the main point stands already. The noble, so I'll just go ahead and skip that. The most noble form of movement is self-movement, and this belongs to living things alone. Likewise, the most noble form of possession is the formal possession of things within oneself through knowledge. So from this one gathers the important, although admittedly not surprising, point that living things are superior to merely existing things, and intelligent things are superior to both merely living and merely existing things. Thus, a clear hierarchy can be discerned. Being, life, and intelligence are an ascending scale of qualities. Different beings attain to different levels of perfection on this scale. Additionally, one must note that what is higher contains within itself the perfections of what is lower. Living things are still existing things, and intelligent things are still living and existing. So, hearing being, life, and intellect and the way they're spoken of and treated by Thomas, we might be tempted to want to classify them merely as additional transcendentals. But that won't work because not everything is living and not everything is intelligent. And we also here might find hinted a connection to Aristotelian psychology where you have vegetative, sensitive, and rational souls. And so we might want to, you know, just completely identify it with that Aristotelian move. But there's something actually different going on here. It's related, but different. And so I'm going to turn to consider exactly the way Thomas regards being, life, and intellect, and the way he would categorize them as perfections. A clearer picture of the triad emerges when one considers God's causal act of giving the characteristics of being, life, and intelligence. There's a wonderful text, the prologue to Book 3 of the Commentary on the Sentences. Aquinas, of course, is offering us a scripture verse as a way to begin, So he cites Ecclesiastes 1:7, quote, "Unto the place from whence the rivers come, they return to flow again," end quote. And the flowing of the rivers signifies a twofold order of God's gifts, the natural gifts he gives to creatures and the divine gift of the incarnation. So concerning the natural gifts, he says, quote, "Those waters are the natural goodnesses or perfections, bonitates, which God infuses into creatures, such as to be, to live, and to understand, and other such things. Concerning these rivers, it can be understood what is said in Isaiah 41, I will open the rivers in the highest of mountains." And so then Aquinas ends saying, "The place from where these rivers go out is God himself." So being, life, and intelligence are here mentioned as principal naturales bonitates, natural excellences or perfections that God imparts to creatures. And this is very consistent as well. It's to hear the language of infusing or flowing out calls to mind the notion of a Neoplatonic sort of emanation, cascade, although obviously understood in a different way, not one that's creative in the sense of mediated creation. Also in the commentary on the Liber de Causis, being, life, and intelligence are mentioned as perfections. Additionally, we find it in the same way in the De Substantiis, in the Treatise on Separate Substances. So while being, life, and intellect are a kind of progressive grouping of perfections in God, Aquinas notes this would be the difference for God. Aquinas notes in the Sentences commentary that being is the best of titles, which contains the other two. Although in other creatures to be, to live, and to know, and all the things of this sort are found according to diverse existences in them, nevertheless, in God, his one simple to be has all of these virtues and perfections. Hence, when God is called a being, it expresses nothing but what pertains to his perfection and the whole perfection itself. And likewise, when he is said to be knowing and willing and the like. And so it's clear that all these things are one in God in reality, but differ according to reason. God, as ipsum esse, contains within himself the fullness of all perfections that are communicated to creatures, and among these perfections, perhaps even first among, we might say, are being, life, and intelligence. They're the natural perfections he pours into creatures. So what type of perfections are these? Well, here I'm going to turn and lead a little bit on the interpretation of L.B. Geiger, who argues that Thomas regards this triad as essential perfections, the essential perfections that can be communicated to creatures. And he almost implies that they're an exhaustive list, or at least they represent a certain type of perfection and are exhaustive of that type. Geiger explains also that perfection has a technical force and serves to precisely designate the fundamental structures of reality. The language of perfection stands within a context of the doctrine of essence and esse. Esse, understood as actus essendi, stands as the perfection of all perfections. Life and intelligence can be understood as further perfections of esse, yet perfections that are not really distinct from esse when possessed by an individual. While I believe Geiger's conceptual title, Essential Perfections, is accurate, I'm hesitant about his claim that they are the essential perfections communicable to creatures. Because perfection, broadly construed, could also include essential attributes of God, such as wisdom and goodness. And they're also essentially one in God. So for this reason, I prefer to title the members of the triad of being, life, and intellect as primary essential divine perfections communicable to creatures. So it leaves us with a kind of emphasis on them without the need to exclude other attributes that may be taken as perfections. Because often, really what leads me to do this is often Aquinas mentions wisdom and goodness in the same breath as being, life, and intellect. So it's clear he's kind of thinking of them all together. The word grade or gradus is a term we've already seen Thomas employ in the commentary on the Liber de Causis. All grades of things to being, life, and intelligence, Geiger would say, this has a technical force. They designate the determinate forms that perfections can take within a context of participation by limitation. So viewed in this way, one can see that the components of the triad do not themselves designate specific grades, but are the primary essential perfections under which many different grades, Geiger actually says a potentially infinite number of grades could be organized. To conclude, or sort of as the final way to take this observation, we could talk about the perfection of the universe. So to elucidate Aquinas' adaptation of this triad, it's worth considering the way he employs it to talk about the perfection of the universe. The perfection of the universe demands diversity, and for this reason, the Creator will decree diverse grades of being. Closely related to this is the discussion of whether God could have made a better universe. So in discussing this question in the commentary on the sentences, Thomas makes appeal to being, life, and intellect as a kind of rubric by where we could judge whether the universe is fittingly perfect. There are many ways of participating, he says, the same divine perfection, just as the intellectual substances participate in divine wisdom in one way, and rational substances, namely men, in another, and even to brute animals, is extended, insofar as they have sense knowledge, a kind of participation in wisdom. Therefore, every perfection may have been communicated to creatures, although not in every way in which it is possible for them to be participated by a creature. So you can see he's trying to hold these two things together. It's precisely this distinction between essential perfections and the grades that fall underneath them that enables one to answer the question of the universe's perfection. God has communicated all the perfections to creatures that can be communicated, and in this sense, the universe has a kind of maximal perfection. And Geiger refers to this as the order of absolute perfection. However, as we've said, underneath the essential perfections of being, life, and intelligence, there's a potentially infinite number of grades, at least according to Geiger. I'm not sure I want to go that far. But the grades of perfection have not been exhausted in his interpretation. The universe could always be better because it could always possess more degrees underneath each essential perfection. So Geiger would call that the order of perfections proper to the creature. And so we see in what way creation is perfect and in what way it could be better. To conclude, the doctrine of the triad of being, life, and intelligence in its original Neoplatonic conception leaves much to be desired. While it attempts to bridge the Platonic gap, it does so at the expense of dividing reality yet further through the assignation of causality to separate hypostases. However, if according to the synthetic brilliance of Aquinas, one conceives of the members of this triad as identical with the divine essence, a new possibility emerges. In this way, the insight of the Neoplatonic heritage may be preserved, albeit in a highly modified respect. Being, life, and intelligence are the primary essential perfections of the divine nature that can be communicated to creatures. The entire structure of created reality is situated within the fundamental frame of these perfections. You could think of them as the joints in the hierarchy of being. They're the fundamental conditions as well we might use to judge the perfection of the universe as a whole. So they are natural perfections that God, as the absolute perfection of each of them, pours into his creatures. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Father. We have about 10 minutes for questions, so.
Thank you very much, Father. In your research, although I realize you were preparing this for a conference on Aquinas and the Greek Fathers, I was wondering, did you find anything interesting related to this particular topic in Aquinas' commentary on Boethius' Hebdomads, particularly with respect to in comparison to how Aquinas is reading Boethius and how he's reading the Dionysius?
That's an excellent question, and that would be sort of the great next step to really situate this all within. It's sort of like any topic quite like this, in a way, needs to begin with a prologue and different types of participation. At least that's the way I'm approaching would think it to be treated adequately. And so, of course, we go to the classic text in the De Hebdomadibus commentary, where you get three different types of participation. So I kind of nod to Fabro and Geiger in various ways in their comment on this particular thing. But I think to really address the whole framework, we would need to look a little bit at Geiger's notion of participation and Fabro's. They're not the only two in the landscape, but they both have a kind of coherent picture that one could offer. They disagree intensely, which makes it fun. Yes, you're right. That's another text that would be, the next recourse.
Thank you.
Father John Baptist.
Thank you. I know it can be difficult to represent graphically, but as you show Proclus, so are the one and good mutually exclusive, or do you just mean they were above?
I should mention that as well. There's some confusion. If I could have erased one part of the graph, I would have erased the one or the good and just gone with the good. I don't mean to suggest that there are two ultimate first principles. That's like, that would be against the whole point. So I just meant to say certain thinkers would prefer calling them the one, certain would prefer calling them good. I really don't know enough about Proclus to really do justice to him, at least at the time that I drew that graph. That would also be another recourse, is to actually dig much deeper into Proclus. I feel great. I feel no burden to explain Plotinus, because we have a talk on that next. please.
Could you say a little more about the force of the word infuses or pours? Because, you know, that's sort of a picture where the thing already exists, and God is pouring into it a certain perfection. But presumably this is what creates that creature, right? Mm-hmm. So how would you understand that in a sort of less metaphorical
way? Mm-hmm. Right. I think it does come down to the giving of being. And, you know, there's going to be a primacy to the actus ascendi. And again, so it's interesting. I was talking, perhaps I focused a lot on the way in which this changes the ultimate first principle in our regard of God as being subsistent, being life and intelligence, but there's another important way in which the unity of the creature needs to be preserved. And so, yes, I think, you know, Aquinas there, sort of like he has the language in mind, perhaps, and he's influenced by that tradition, but he's obviously going to use it in a different way. I'm thinking of Father Koo's lecture actually yesterday, we were talking about different modes of causality. I think, again, this would get back to the kind of central issues of participation. And really the big fight between Fabro and Geiger comes down to the primacy one assigns to the type of participation, whether the composition of the creature and the composition of an essay is primary, or whether in a way the causality coming from God is primary. So that would be an additional kind of avenue to pursue. So Aquinas is using the language. Here it's in a prologue, so I don't think he's terribly committed to the technicality of it, and I think he really is commenting on scripture. But it's nice to see the gesture towards what he's read and been influenced by. Thank you for the question.
You did a great job. I'm taking Aquinas and going forward as you took him and went back. And a lot of the bias semioticians today are really saying how, for them, life is identified with the ability to perceive and interact with their environment. Would anything essential be lost to Thomas if intelligence and life were identified instead of distinguished?
I think so, because precisely because insofar as understanding these different essential perfections as sort of displayed in the cascade of the hierarchy of being, we need to distinguish, actually this is a very important point that is challenged today, because everyone wants to believe that their dog is on the same ontological scale they are. We need to have a big distinction between life and intelligence, you know, those things that are merely living, or that's the ultimate perfection of them, and those that are intelligent.
But you had mentioned that sense intelligence was something that Thomas...
As a very qualified sense, yeah, as a very qualified understanding of intelligence, because there is at least sense knowledge, you know. The dog can possess at least some phantasm of something within itself, and so that's somewhat of a higher mode of knowing, or that's somewhat of a mode of knowing, I should say, albeit at the beginning. And so part of what you see in the hierarchy of being is not only are there distinct grades, there's a kind of continuity between each, but it's not as though it's a complete inclined plane. It's actually more, if you were to draw the hierarchy of being, I think according to, there's no markers, ooh, one. If you were to draw it according to Aquinas, it wouldn't look like our exit sign for stairs. It would be a bit more like this, where there are still distinct changes. So like, let's say here's man and here's animal. There's still a gap there, a very big one. And then for understanding being, life, and intelligence as fundamental divisions, we're going to put man and animal on the, or we're going to put man and angels on the spiritual side, obviously. So no matter how much that animal gets close to human intelligence, there's still going to be a distinct gap there. no matter how much that plant, the Venus flytrap, gets close to being to having sense knowledge or having some kind of sensory reaction, there's still going to be a jump to get to the clam, you know, which Aquinas calls an imperfect animal because it can't move. There's still, it's a more sophisticated organism, which is interesting, I think. Anyway, there's overtones you could have with current veganism and all of that. Where do you draw the line? What are you willing to eat? I mean, I talked to a vegan and says, sure, I'll eat clams, you know. It's like, okay, so you're fine with imperfect animals? So, anyway. Do we have one more time for time?
I think so, yes.
With Geiger, whom you use, how does he deal with the problem that you have more or less perfect universes? Is he speaking relative to ens commune, or is he trying to speak in absolute terms? Because it seems to me that you have a problem with forced creation of the perfect universe, if one universe can be better than another.
So are you asking whether he thinks that there could potentially be different universes?
No. So we have, you know, every being that's somehow in gradation, creatable, mm-hmm. makes the universe better. Is that objectively speaking or only relative to itself? Because it seems to me that if God is creating less good universes, it doesn't seem to be doing a very good job.
Right, and this is, the great book on this is Blanchett, The Perfection of the Universe in Thomas Aquinas. And I think that's precisely what this distinction helps you to see, is that there's a kind of fundamental perfection. This is what Geiger's contention is. For the universe to be perfect, at least in a basic sense, it needs to have these fitting grades of being. You know, the quote that just will kind of, obviously, he's very indebted to Dionysius, but the one that really illustrates it for me and has theological overtones is in the Summa Contra Gentiles, when St. Thomas says, God, in wishing to represent himself and show forth his goodness, needed, and not in the sense of a strict necessity, but it was very fitting.
My preoccupation is God has needs.
Right. Well, right. This is relative. Right? This is understood in a much different sense. So just as we, in attempting to give another that one single conception in our mind, need to circumlocute and use many different words to sort of get to that one word and expression we're trying to have, so too God, in expressing his goodness, needed to use a diversity and multitude of creatures in order to fittingly diffuse his goodness. So I just like that quote a lot. So
thank you, Father.